Greetings, friends, and welcome back, or welcome to the High Flyers Podcast, the community for the curious ones, where we share diverse experiences in life, not just work. Tune in and learn to fly high in your own way, from value creators and problem solvers in all aspects of society. Learn about their sunrise, magic moments, hustle, and so much more to help us all be 1% better every day together. And I'm your host, Vidit Agarwal.
We've got like 1,000 people in the room. The music's pumping, the lasers are flying, the smoke's going off. And then I walk off the stage after screaming his name, and then he doesn't come out. So it gave me an opportunity. Then I had to go back out and fill. So it gave me an opportunity for like 45 minutes to really test myself, I guess, to think off the cuff. I had nothing planned. And train like 1,000 people in a room and hold a room. And I think that was a really pivotal moment for me personally. I haven't really spoke about this, but giving me confidence that I belong in that world, because I think we all have that, what's it called, imposter syndrome.
That's Ryan Tuckwood, and this is episode 38. We talk about so much. Ryan's humble upbringing in the UK, with his mum being a cleaner, and dad, a factory worker, starting off with a desire to be a footballer, and then how seeing his dad have cancer made Ryan want to do more with his life. We talk about his introvertedness, the 60-second legacy, what people think of you 60 seconds after you meet them, how seeing a fortune teller led Ryan to pack up and move to Australia, failures, and how a job he hated turned into the best learning, led him to founding a business, which he eventually secured funding on the infamous show Shark Tank, and hear about behind the scenes of that process, and Ryan's mantra in life: go to bed more educated than you woke up. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Vidit. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you on. We like starting off with asking the guests to give a quick overview on who they are. So did you want to share a bit about yourself and where you are in life today?
My name is Ryan Tuckwood. I'm the CEO and co-founder here at Swish Sales Coaching. I'm based here on the beautiful Gold Coast. In my opinion, one of the best places in the world. You've probably got my accent by now. I'm actually English. So I moved here in 2010. So 11 years deep now. Just recently, last couple of weeks, got my permanent residency. And sitting here now with my sales team, out on the sales floor behind me, having a huge day on a beautiful sunny Friday afternoon.
Good stuff, mate. I did see your announcement on LinkedIn of the citizenship. Congratulations!
That's a big
milestone, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't think I was in any danger of being thrown out. My wife's Kiwi, so I was on a de facto visa to her, but it never led to permanent residency. And then I got a tap on the shoulder in December that somebody from the Office of Home Affairs actually reached out and asked me if I'd heard of the Distinguished Talent Visa, and they asked me if I'd apply for it, and I'm like, didn't even
is that what it's called?
Yeah, I'd never even. Yeah, it's a visa that historically it was saved for like sports stars and actors and actresses that wanted to move to Australia, and in November last year they opened up to entrepreneurs that are having an impact, in their words. I got approached, so it went through in like 8 weeks. In the end, it was really, really quick.
Oh, fantastic. Well, listeners, we've got a distinguished talent on the show today. So
it's a weird phrase, but I'll take it.
No, very good. Let's zoom back a bit go back to your early days growing up in the UK and your sunrise, as I call it. What was that like, Ryan? What was growing up there, and what were your sort of early memories?
Early memories, like for me, life was really, really good. Like, I come from a very humble home. Mum was a cleaner. Dad was a factory worker. He used to work nights. I do remember that quite often that they would cross over on the driveway as mum was going to work. Dad would be coming in from work, so it was a very much a working household, and financially things were always tight, but it was a very, very loving home. Like, my mum and dad are still together in their 60s, which is rare, I guess, these days. And for me personally, I was just obsessed with football or soccer, as most kids are in England, or seems to be. And I got an older sister, younger brother. I guess the general household fights and challenges that go on. But to this day, I'm thankful for the upbringing that I had. I think I've had no money. I've had lots of money, but hopefully I'm like respectful for how we make money. And when we do have it, the power that it holds to be able to impact other people as well. And I think that comes from my childhood.
And when you think back to young Ryan, maybe when you're 10 years old or teenager, what were some of your passions through school and life?
I'd say I only really had one, but as you started asking that question, I thought of another one. My main one was just be a footballer, mate. Like, I was a standard English kid. Like, I didn't want nothing else to do than be a professional footballer. I'm not the tallest bloke in the world. I'm only like 5'8". So I think I was vertically challenged and that wasn't going to help me. And I'm a skinny bugger as well. But so there was that. But I also enjoyed art, which I don't think I've ever spoke about this on a podcast. I really enjoy like drawing and just being quite creative in that as well. So academically, I was okay. I wasn't like the smartest kid there, but I was probably middle of the road. But art is one area that I excelled at, and same with sport.
Mm. One of the things we talk a lot about in the show is I think people being a product of the environment, but also being a product of the influences around them. Yeah. And you mentioned your parents. Were there any other influences you had through high school or through sport that you look back on that you think formed your opinion, but also your worldview?
I don't know. No, I don't think so. Not back then. I feel like I've really changed direction more when I moved over here. So during my childhood, no, I think I was... I'm an introvert by nature, so I wasn't really a kid that would like to go out into social settings, or even I didn't go out to kids' parties. Mum and dad always joked that as a child, they thought I had weird social anxiety issues, in their words, that if we went out for dinner, I'd take my shoes off and sit under a table. I wouldn't talk to anybody. I never had like any ambition around me. None of my parents' friends were affluent or rich, but it probably wasn't until my later years, until I actually fell into the engineering world, that I met a guy called Merv, Merv Yunson, and a Scottish guy. And the conversations with him were constantly about what he didn't do in his life, and things that he wanted to achieve, but he didn't. And he always erred on the side of caution. So when I started throwing out ideas of potentially moving to Australia one day, he was very much in my corner, backing me and pushing me to go. So that's the one person I talk about a lot when you talk about people that have molded, not necessarily who I am, but where I am right now and why I'm in the position I'm in. And then also my dad. My dad got cancer at the age of 42. He got esophagus cancer. And I would have been maybe 18, 19 at the time. My brother was like 14. My sister was a couple of years older. And watching my dad at the age of 42, of which I thought that was old at the time, and I'm nearly 40 now, which is pretty scary. And watching him go through all of that, I think conversations with him again when I thought about moving to Australia, he's like, son, you only live once, right? You never know what's going to happen to you. I mean, he smoked like a chimney back then. I don't smoke, but he says, look, I didn't ask for this, and I've got sick, and it's kind of taken the rest of my life away from me, so to speak. So Merv and my dad are definitely two people that have really kind of encouraged and shaped why I'm probably on this podcast right now here in Australia.
There's some really good thoughts there. I think that the part that I'm intrigued about, and we talked about this leading up to the recording, is your introverted nature growing up, because I can resonate with that really well. I was very similar, and I really struggled to open up. And now when I meet people, and I'm sure you do as well, people probably assume that you're an extrovert.
Yes.
And that's something that I think people struggle with, because they go, oh, you seem so extroverted now. How were you introverted growing up? Like, how did you evolve?
Sure.
And then for me, it was getting a job at a restaurant when I was about 14, and that changed my life. How what was it like for you looking back then? Like, because particularly in life before social media, a lot of it was in person and school, and particularly sport and things, right? How did you deal with that? And I think also listeners might be wondering, when they see you on TV or on social media, going, Ryan seems just really smooth, he's really good at what he does. Like, were there any things you were able to do to get through that introverted nature that he looked back on?
Yeah, I mean, you referenced sport in there as well. I mean, there was I always had a weird sort of white line fever, they call it, don't they? When you walk across the line onto the pitch, like I became a different person, and I had this sort of aggression and energy about me that definitely wasn't introverted. But as soon as that whistle went and I got off the pitch again, I go back into my shell, and everyday life has always been the same for me. Like I never wanted to be the center of attention. I'd actually get like a rash on my neck and get real nervous and sweaty at the idea of even public speaking or even like trying to make a sale. But I don't know if I've had a definitive moment where I've like trained to get it out of me. I'm not sure if that can happen. What I have had is a definitive moment of why I need to push myself more. And you referenced social media. It came back in 2017. So just prior to the Shark Tank experience that we went through, my creative director, or at the time, creative director Courtney had encouraged Jack and I, the other co-founder, to start putting ourselves out there more and be more of a presence online. She kept referencing that people buy people, they don't buy brands. So we need to put ourselves out there and put more content out there. And at the time, my Facebook was private. I didn't have a LinkedIn. My Instagram was private. And I kept very much to myself. And so I said, all right, we'll give it a go. And we did. And I decided to put my first video out there. It's on YouTube somewhere. If you search Ryan Tuckwood, I think it's called Your 60-Second Legacy or Your 60-Second Wow. And it was based around when you leave somebody's presence, that they're always thinking something about you. In the next 60 seconds, what are they thinking about you? Right? We all leave a little 60-second legacy. So I made this quick video and I put it out there. And I probably filmed it about 18 times to get it nowhere near perfect. And I put it on social media, and then I went football training that night, and all the football lads were like giving me abuse about it. They're like, oh, here comes Ryan, get ready, here comes a Facebook Live, and they started holding their phones up at me. And in my head, I'm like, no, this is why I didn't do it. I knew I shouldn't have done it, right? I got all this abuse. And then a couple of days later, I got a random message from a guy in Brisbane that I'd never met before, must have been following the company page. And he just messaged me saying, hey, Ryan, just wanted to say we haven't met, but that video you put up the other day, it was exactly what I needed to hear. I've been having a bit of a downer for a few days now, and it really kind of perked me up for the rest of the day. And whatever it was, thank you very much. And I had this little feeling inside as I read that message. I'm like, oh my God, like I wonder how many people have watched that video that actually did like it, that maybe it did resonate with them. And in that moment, I was somehow, and I don't know the psychology behind it, but somehow I was able to channel that. The happiness of impacting one people was more powerful than my mates abusing me. So I decided to just continue doing it. And over time, I got a little bit more confident in front of the camera. It didn't take me 18 times, and I got over my perfectionist mentality around it. And then in 2018, after Shark Tank, I got introduced to a guy called Harry Singer, who's a public speaking coach. He works with the likes of Tony Robbins, Richard Branson, Robert Kiyosaki. And I actually engaged his services. He's based over in the UK. And I said, all I want to achieve out of this training is to not be fearful of speaking in front of three people. Like I used to get really nervous. The first ever seminar we did, three people turned up and I didn't do it. I bottled it. I let my business partner do it. I said, I just want to remove that fear. And within 18 months, I was standing on stage in front of 1,100 people for 8 hours, being the MC for Jordan Belfort in Sydney and Melbourne, 2 days in a row. And well and truly overcame my fear of public speaking. I've still got a natural sort of default introvert nature. There's a weird sort of thing that kind of happened. I now prefer it on stage than I do in the crowd. I prefer to be the one person on the stage in front of 1,000 than networking with the 1,000, if that makes any sort of sense.
No, great story. Thank you for sharing that in a bit of detail. I think that the learning there, perhaps for listeners, is if you put yourself out there and and have 1% of belief in yourself, it sort of can work out, right? And you just got to keep trying. I think that's what's happened in my journey, and it sounds like that's what happened in your journey as well.
For sure. And I think knowing why you're doing it, like, is there, so am I putting myself out there just for the sake of saying I want to put myself out there, or is there a genuine like reason behind it and an emotional attachment? For me, it was all part of this business of knowing that there must be other people out there that are in sales or business, or maybe they're not maximizing their own potential for fear of looking stupid or rejection, or they just don't know what to do or say in those environments. So if there was one person that we could help or I could help, then it was worth me overcoming my own insecurities.
And probably also, I think having a supporter there, like from my example, this restaurant, my mum took me to the restaurant to get a job there, and she spoke on my behalf. So I think if you have someone kind of believing in you, that makes you believe in yourself. So I think if you connect those two, you can sort of make magic happen, right?
I think that's a really good point, right? I used to think you are the sum of the five people you surround yourself with. I used to think that was so fluffy. Same as vision boards and goal setting. I never used to believe in any of that until I did it. And then it worked. And having that network of people that maybe see your potential better than you do, I think is really, really important.
Now you've touched in aspects there around your Shark Tank experience and entrepreneurship, which we'll go into shortly. But if we think back to your teenage years, and as you were maybe 18, 19, mm-hmm. what were your aspirations? Did you know what you wanted to do in life as you were sort of coming out of high school and sort of going, what's next? How do you think of that now?
I got released from, I played for Leicester City, like youth up until the age of 16, 17, and I got released from there. And then I kind of lost a little bit of direction there. Not that I had any other direction apart from being a footballer. And then I thought, well, I love sports. So maybe I'll become a physiotherapist, or a personal trainer or something like that. So went to college to do that, got my personal training qualification, but never really acted upon it. At the age of 18, I ironically, with my own, like the way that I am as an introvert, I actually decided to go and work in Greece for 6 months. So I went on holiday with two mates, and we had no intention of coming home. And I told my parents that I didn't just leave. And I worked out there, and that was a time in my life where I really kind of pushed myself and put myself out there. Bearing in mind, I probably looked like I was about 12 years old, these blonde curtains. And I was working outside the bars. I was one of those annoying people that was trying to get people into bars. And I loved it. I was pretty much drunk for the whole summer. And then I came back, and I didn't have a job. I didn't know what I was doing. And my auntie, who was, she worked for a recruitment agency, and they placed people in companies in the engineering sector. And she was like, oh, Ryan, like, I can get you a temporary job if you want as an apprentice at an engineering company. Just do it for a few weeks whilst you find your feet when you're back. So I did that. And then after a while, I started to teach myself how to use the machines, got to know some of the people that worked there. And then a job offer came up, and then they ended up sponsoring me and putting me through my engineering qualifications. So I kind of fell into that. I didn't really plan it. And then for the next 8 years, I was an engineer, mechanical maintenance engineering. I started earning some really, really good money, all totally by accident. Like, I never ever said I want to become an engineer. So I did that all the way until the age of 27.
Yeah. And then obviously moved to Australia, which we'll go into. Now, I think I love talking about magic moments in the show, because this is something that I think there's always those moments that perhaps were an asterisk in your journey, right? Looking back, that either were a painful learning or a great experience, or just something that you look back on and you go, that played a role in who I am today as a person in life, not just work. And it sounds like you've had some really diverse experiences mm-hmm. through your journey. Are there any that stand out for you that you look back on fondly that are magical, whether good or bad?
Yeah, magical is a good word for it, right? I don't know if it's probably magical or spiritual. And I'll precursor this by saying, like, I'm personally not religious or spiritual, even though I am getting more spiritual in my old age, is what I normally say. it'd probably be really clear moment. So this would have been back in maybe 2009, a year before I moved here. So going back to Merv, the guy I spoke about earlier, he. So I was talking to him on a shift, and he said to me that him and his wife, when they were in their 20s, they were going to move to Australia. She was a nurse. She could have got sponsored, and they decided not to. And this was like 20 years prior. And he says, oh, I wish I'd have done this. I wish I'd have done this. And then I was telling him I wanted to move to Australia. I was thinking about it. And he said, you got to do it. And he said, I'm going to pay for you to go and see the medium that I see. And I don't know if you've ever had your cards read or anything like that. And I'm like, mate, I'm nobody's going to tell me what my future is. That is a load of rubbish. Like, I don't believe in that. He goes, I'll pay for you to go. It was £100. So that wouldn't have been cheap. So he drove me there, right? We went to see this woman called Julie. And I'm such a skeptical person, right? I'm an engineer. Everything's logical. Everything has to make sense. And I'm sitting there with her and she says, I can sense you're a bit skeptical. And I was like, no, I'm open-minded, but I wasn't. And then she said to me, probably about 2 or 3 minutes in, she said, you miss your granddad, don't you? Now, one of my granddads I didn't really see, and then the other one died when I was 2 years old. And I was like, yeah, I guess so. And I was like, yeah, whatever. She could say that to anybody. And she goes, you miss driving the car up and down his leg, don't you? And I'm like, what? And I got these chills all over me because I'd never told anybody this, and the only ones that would know would be my mum and dad. But the only memory I've got of my granddad, he died literally when I was two, was driving a little car up and down his shin. That's all I remember doing with him. And apparently I used to do it all the time. And I'm like, in my head, I'm like, how did you know that, right? So after she said that, I believed everything she said, right? She got me. She sold me.
Are you sure she wasn't a long-distance cousin?
this is where my brain started to go. So then later on, she then said, so this is the first time. I ended up going to see her twice. This is the first time. And then she said, bearing in mind, in the back of my mind, right, I'm thinking about moving to Australia at some stage. And then she said, are you and your girlfriend having a baby? And I'm like, I hope not. I said, no, I don't think so. She goes, there's a baby. Somebody's pregnant. The next day, my brother told us him and his partner were pregnant, like the very next day.
Wow.
So after that, I went back to see her about 2 months later because I just needed to be clear on like what was happening again. And then she said to me, I feel like you were born in the wrong country. You should have been born in the sun. Like, you like the sun. You should have been born near the beach. And that was it. I was done. I broke up with my girlfriend about a month later and decided that I was going to plan to move to Australia. I was like, I'm in the wrong place. So that would be a magical, spiritual, weird, freaky moment that definitely shaped why I'm here right now.
Yeah. While you're saying that, I'm just wondering, is that fate or is that just coincidence? I don't know, but fantastic.
I've always been one of those people that goes, you believe what you want to believe and you make the story and the narrative fit whatever you really want. So it was only the pregnancy and then the car thing, like that. I'm like, there's no way she could have known that. So the other one, which would be, I don't remember again if it's a magical moment, but last year when I was MC for Jordan Belfort, so he came over here and did an Australian tour just pre-COVID. And I was fortunate enough to host the day for him. A couple of occasions, he just decided he didn't want to come out. So I got like 1,000 people in the room. The music's pumping, the lasers are flying, the smoke's going off. And then I walk off the stage after screaming his name, and then he doesn't come out. So it gave me an opportunity. Then I had to go back out and fill. So it gave me an opportunity for like 45 minutes to really test myself, I guess, to think off the cuff because I had nothing planned. And train like 1,000 people in a room and hold a room. And I think that was a really pivotal moment for me personally. Okay, I've not really spoke about this, but giving me confidence that I belong in that world, because I think we all have that, what's it called, imposter syndrome from time to time. And even when I'm training sometimes, you're working with some huge organizations, it's like, do they enjoy this? Should I be doing this? Have I earned the right to be here? And in that moment, I think I validated to myself that I had. So I'm thankful that he decided to not keep time and not care about me. It gave me an opportunity to kind of prove myself to me as well.
Yeah, incredible. It's almost like a full circle back to what he spoke about earlier about being introverted and putting yourself out there, right?
Yeah. And being thrown into it as well. Like if you'd have said to me, okay, Ryan, right, you're going to MC for Jordan, even like 6 months before, I'd have said no. If you'd have then said you got to do like 45-minute stints as well and train the whole room, I'd have freaked out. So because it didn't happen like that, because I got thrust into it, I had to. It was like sink or swim, right? And I've got hundreds of hours worth of sales training I can deliver, so it was fine. But I still had to do it en masse, and I'd never trained a group that size before, so it actually worked out pretty well.
And what was the experience? I don't know if you got a chance to interact with Jordan himself, because obviously he's done. There's the movie about him and quite a polarizing figure. what was that experience like?
Depends who's going to listen to the podcast. He's an interesting character, right? On stage, I'll say he is extremely charismatic. Like, he's unbelievable. He's a great trainer. He knows his stuff. Behind the scenes, and we spent 2 days with him. So we flew from Sydney to Melbourne together. We were in the backstage together. He didn't really interact with everybody else backstage. He came in, he got his job done, and he was brilliant at his job. But behind the scenes, it probably is exactly what you expect. He was kept himself to himself, went back to his green room, but came out on stage and delivered. So he is polarizing. I mean, our company is called Swish, which stands for Selling with Integrity and Selling Honestly. And there was even a little bit of nervousness in house about, Ryan, why are you aligning with Jordan, right? He's obviously got a reputation, rightly or wrongly. Like, I believe that everybody deserves a second chance. But in my eyes, it gave me a platform for us to elegantly show people en masse that maybe see sales in a different light. Maybe they see it as only in the way that it's been projected through the movie. And I wanted to be able to show people that it can be done a different way, that it can be authentic, it can be real, and we can make money, be successful, and not have to rip people off at the same time.
Well, that actually reminds me of an experience I had back in Melbourne. This might have been 2012 or 13, where he came to do an event, and I actually paid about $100 to go see him live. It was at the Crown Casino in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And I think what I took away from that is maybe not the content, but just the marketing brand that he had built attracted me, and I got influenced by that. And that often is a big part of human connection, right? You connect to, often back to what he said earlier, that lesson you were taught earlier on, people connect to people. And maybe there's a level of curiousness where you're going, oh, this person's a bit different and a bit almost questions the norm. Let's just go and see what he's actually about. Let's see him in person. Let's just see how he talks. And I think that was that inspiration for me to go and watch him live.
Well, I mean, he's a very good sales trainer. Like he knows his stuff, and the things that he teaches, some of it works. In my opinion, not all of it is relevant to today's market, but some of it does work, and it works very well. It's always up to the end user what they do with those skills. Like sales, and this is me going full circle, I never used to believe that it was a skill. Sales is a skill. Anybody can learn it. Anybody can do it. Will some people do it better than others? Yes, the same as every skill. But what you do with that is up to you. So all we have to make sure we do is consistently hammer home the message of just doing right by people. We have what we call our invisible integrity line. So once you get to the end of a consultation or a discovery, you ask yourself honestly, hand on heart, does this person require my services, and should I be asking them for the business or taking the money off them? And if not, then you let them go and wish them all the best.
Now, on Magic Moments, Ryan, I wonder if you had any painful learnings that you look back on. I think the listeners of the show really resonate with these, because often they look at someone like yourself and they go, Ryan's had a lot of success and a lot of wins, but I'm sure there's some down moments there that taught you a lot about yourself and the world. Is there one that stands out that you can share that was a painful, but it was a learning?
Yeah, absolutely. So the main one is probably a bit more recent, as recent as 2011, would be when I first fell into sales. So coming over here as somebody that had been in engineering for a very long time, and I was good at it, right? It wasn't something that I loved, but I was pretty good at it, I do believe. Coming over here and then just failing for all intents and purposes. So when I got here as a backpacker, you can only work for one company for 6 months. And I actually fell into call center work initially. So my job was pick up the phone, 300 dials a day, I had 90 seconds to find out if somebody had $15,000 to $25,000 in their back pocket. Now, so you imagine if I called you out of the blue, cold call, and asked you if you got how much money you got in the bank, then you're probably going to abuse me. No, you're probably quite nice, so you probably wouldn't. But most people abuse you, right? And it's so you could probably put this into context now. You take that introvert kid out of Leicester in the UK and then put him into a call center before any public speaking training or confidence training and just abuse him for 8 hours, that gets to you. And in a call center, or where I was anyway, there was a sales board. I was 21 out of 21 people. So not only was I hating it, but everybody knew I was crap as well because it was on a board. And then it got to a stage where it was March the, I've got it because I've got a screenshot of it that I show when I do training. It was March the 8th, 2011. I had 31 cents in my bank. I've got a screenshot of my bank. I don't know why I did it. I put it on Facebook back in the day. And at the same time, I was sleeping on a bathroom floor on a Lilo or a pool floaty, you would call it here in Australia. And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday morning. That pool floaty just went poof, and just popped on me. And I remember sinking to the floor, laying there in the darkness of the night, just like, what am I doing? Like, what am I trying to achieve? Like, I hate sales. I'm no good at it. I get anxiety going in and picking up the phone. And me and my wife, so Alicia, my wife, she was my girlfriend at the time, and stuck with me for all of this. There was one stage we were in a sub, a sushi place on the Gold Coast, and we couldn't even afford $10 between the two of us. So that's what I call my rock bottom, I think. And when we get to that sort of crisis point, we all have a decision to make, and you either dig your heels in, or you and give it a good go, or you quit. So what I did was quit. So the next morning, I went into the office, and I pulled my sales manager aside, who was Jack, and he's actually my he's the co-founder of this company. He's exited now, but he's a co-founder. And I said to him, mate, sales ain't for me. Like, I can't do this. Sales is for people that have got the gift of the gab. They're confident. They're extroverts. And he just looked at me dead in the eyes, and he said, Ryan, I'm not letting you quit because you haven't even tried. Now, in that moment, like I was like, are you serious? Like, I'm trying my hardest here. I'm in at 7. I leave at 7. I'm in on Saturdays. I'm working hard. He goes, you haven't. He says, you haven't truly tried to master the art and craft of sales. He says, you've never looked into NLP, behavioral science, emotional intelligence. You've never done any professional negotiation training. He says, give me 60 days. And I've since found out that it takes an average of 66 days to form new habits and behaviors. So he said, give me 60 days. He says, I want you to fanatically obsess over the art and craft of sales for the next 2 months. And if in 60 days you're still 21st out of 21 people, I'll pay for you and Alicia to fly wherever you want. She's from Auckland. Fly wherever you want, but go home with your head held high, knowing that you gave this a really good go. Now, in my head, I'm like, perfect. I've got free flights. I self-sabotage, or I previously did. So I didn't want it to work. So I started to do what he said. He's like, mate, just read these books, watch these videos, and just start listening to other people on the phones on your breaks. So I'm studying all like the old school greats, like Jim Rohn, Tom Hopkins, Brian Tracy, Zig Ziglar, Ron Willingham, Jordan Belfort, Grant Cardone, like anything I could find. And then within 5 weeks, I went from 21st to first. And I never got knocked off top spot. From there, then within 18 months, I was running a team of 47. And then in 2013, by the end of the year, I did $334,000 in commissions. And I'm like, wow, this is crazy. All I've done is, not all I've done, but in its most simplistic form, is changed the order of which I say a few words, changed how I say a few words, because everyone was reading the same script. And my life has changed completely. And in that moment, Vidya, I recognized two things. And this is hugely pivotal for me. The first thing I recognized whilst going through this training was that, firstly, sales is impact. Having the ability to finance and support my own family through my dad's sickness. They don't own a house. They rent. They've got no pension or superannuation. Being able to send their money home regularly and support them was unbelievable for me. And secondly, Sales is a process. Just like engineering, sales is a system, and there's a framework, and there's an order of which you have to do things. And if you get it right, you can massively have impact on both your own life and everyone else around you. And that changed the whole trajectory of my life, because as I then became the sales manager and I started recruiting and hiring people, I could see people giving up like I did after a week, after 2 weeks, after a month. And they were saying the same things, that sales isn't for me. And I just knew in that moment that there's probably thousands of people around the world, initially it was Gold Coast, Queensland, Australia, now the world, that are struggling and failing when they don't need to be, because this can be taught. And that's when in 2014, we broke away and we created what is now known as Swish Sales Coaching.
Tell me about that, because you there was a few steps there, right? One was obviously this experience, but then there was something called Shark Tank. And I think we've seen that on TV, and we might know people who have been on it, but you obviously had a good run at it, and you, I think, got some significant funding through it. Can you share that experience? Like, how did that come about? And then maybe if there's any behind the scenes experiences there, like how did they actually, especially back to, again, your nature, your core being introverted, where you're in front of four sharks, so to speak, and you're presenting, and you've got a certain amount of time to get their buy-in, right? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, so, well, you're exactly right. Firstly, you get 90 seconds. So when the doors open, you get given a 90-second pitch, and then they open up for questions. But just rolling it back slightly, it would have been about December 2017/ January 18. I remember Jack approaching me in the office, and he said, mate, how do you feel about going on Shark Tank? And I was like, why? Like, what? In my head, we'd been pretty successful for the last 3 years. We were training job seekers and helping them find work as well in sales. So we're doing like sales training boot camps. We'd placed 2,500 people into work. So we had a great reputation. And I'm like, why would we do that? Why would we risk everything? Like, because I'm quite conservative. And then he goes, well, it's a little bit late because we've already been accepted. And I was like, oh, okay. So he wasn't asking me. He was telling me that we were going on there. And bearing in mind, this is pre like any sort of training, hated public speaking, wouldn't speak in front of three people. And he wants to put me in a shark tank with five sharks. So the decision was made very quickly that Jack would do it. I'd be like, mate, you go on. This is your arena. And it just so happened that the filming was on my wedding anniversary in March. So it was I had the perfect excuse. So I'm like, well, I've already booked Bali. So I'm not going to be able to go. So you go on. We'll train for it. And we did. We've got a 10-step process. We call it the negotiation ladder. We trained our pitch around that. And as a bit of an insider, just so you can get some behind the scenes, the show, they provide you with, I guess, a producer, but they also help you with your pitch. So they want to make sure that you don't totally flop, right? You have, so you have to do police checks and psychiatric testing as well before you go on the show, so that they know you can handle the pressure. The producer that we had, that he kept saying, are you guys, do you want to go on together, or is it just going to be Jack? And it was like, no, Jack, just Jack. And then a couple of weeks before, I had I spoke to Jake, the producer, by himself, and he was like, Ryan, just so you know, like, sometimes the sharks, they like one person, but then they don't like the other. So we have found that if people can go on together, it does double your chances of getting something. So I was like, oh, all right. So I spoke with Alicia about it, and she's like, just do it. Like, whatever. Like, what's the worst that could happen? Let Jack do all the talking. Anyway, so we got in touch, and I was like, yeah, okay, I'll do it. I'll come on. And then they said, you've left it too late. You can't do your police checks now. There's no time to do your psychiatric testing. So it's too late. So I'm like, perfect. Like, I've got out of it. But I've pretended that I wanted to do it. So they said, all right, well, all you have to do, we'll both fly down to Sydney. And then Ryan, when Jack goes in, if it goes to a decision, so if any of the sharks make an offer, Jack will be able to come out to the back of the studio, talk to you about the offer. He'll go back in there and accept whatever you guys want to accept. I'm like, okay, awesome. So I don't go in the tank. They're like, nope. I'm like, sweet. So anyway, we got down there. We had to be there at like 6 a.m. Filming didn't then. They do three sessions in the morning, three in the afternoon, or three people they film. Sharks stay there all day. And One lady went before us, and then Jack finally got called down about 11 o'clock. So he went. I was like, all right, good luck, mate. Enjoy it. 45 minutes went by. Me and my wife were sitting there waiting. And then all of a sudden, this runner comes up to me. And she's like, all right, Ryan, we need you. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I was like, say bye to Alicia. And then we started, we're literally running. I know why they're called runners now. So we're running to the studio from, I was literally sitting in a gazebo on a plastic chair, right? So it's not fancy. And we're running along, and then they start putting a microphone on my back and start putting makeup on me. And I'm like, what, why have I got makeup on me? And they're like, oh, you're going in. The Sharks want to see you. And I'm like, what? And I just started like freaking out. I'm like, no, like I haven't done my police checks. You don't. They were like, well, apparently Steve Baxter had asked for, he said, oh, well, bearing in mind there's a 50% shareholder, we want to see both the shareholders or both founders. So, and as soon as the Shark said that, it overrides everything else. So that's why I was able to go in. So then they got me to the back of the studio. Jack was waiting there and he says, oh, mate, we got four offers. I'm like, awesome. So then about, I don't know, maybe 20, 25 minutes went past. Jack and I are having a discussion about who do we want. We knew we wanted Steve Baxter originally, but we were also very aware that no one in the history of the show had got three investors before, not in Australia. So we discussed back and forth, could we get three? Put a bit of a plan together on how we could achieve that. Went back in the tank, of which I remember standing outside these massive doors. Like, they're so big. Mm. And I felt like I was standing there for an hour. It was probably like 30 seconds. And then they were like, you could hear them going, Sharks ready, contestant ready. Yeah, brilliant. Open the doors. And then they opened, they're just, and to be fair, when they opened the doors, they were all like beaming. They're all smiling and happy. And they were quite nice. And if you've seen the episode, they, I think it's Naomi says, oh, there's another one. And I went, yeah, I'm the little one. And I don't know why I bloody said that. The first words out of my mouth were, yeah, I'm the little one. And then, yeah, probably in there for another hour or so, negotiating back and forth, and ended up, as you said, yeah, getting an investment from Steve, Andrew and Glenn, which was bloody amazing experience. Like, it was all very surreal in the moment. It's like an out-of-body experience to think that you've watched this show. I've watched Dragon's Den back in the UK so many times. But then to be standing in there at the end of this carpet and then five, like, most amazing minds in Australia just staring back at you, like, sell me. Like, it was pretty cool. Then I guess following on from there, a little bit naive because we'd never raised capital before. We didn't really know what happens. Mm. You then go through 6 months or a prolonged amount of due diligence. Like, for us, it took 6 months. And because we had three investors, it took longer than most. So yeah, they rip your business apart. They go through everything that you've provided them, all of your financials. You got to prove that you're getting the results that you suggested with your clients. They went through my background, Jack's background. And then in September, finally, we got it over the line and managed to retain all three. And then April last year, so just during COVID, they actually increased their stake in the business as well.
Oh, fantastic. Congratulations.
Yeah.
It sounds amazing. I've been fortunate to just obviously watch the show, but even just speak to, I think, the investor process and obviously now in the tech world, it's massive with VCs and with angels. I think that whole process, there's a lot. That's why I was curious to understand the behind the scenes, because there's a lot more than what you see on a newspaper headline, particularly that due diligence space. I think people forget that sometimes because they think they just go through it and it's signed and done, but they can still back out. So,
well, I wasn't aware of that, but like, I assumed if it went through on the show, that's a deal. But what we've since found out is that 92% of offers on the show don't go through.
Wow.
So not literally less than 10% of them actually finish with an investment, mostly because people frig their numbers or they presented something that wasn't true and they get found out during the DD period. So really, really proud that we, I'd say survived it. That makes it sound like we weren't sure, but just to have some those people go through our business, look at everything and then surmise after 6 months that, yeah, that's a good business. It gave us credibility in an industry that is tarnished, but it also validated to us that we were onto a good thing and gave us a big oomph of belief as well.
Yeah, no, fantastic. Now, if you dig a bit deeper into your hustle, Ryan, and talk about your hustle today and your last couple of years, how would you describe your role within the business and just generally what are some of your accountabilities and deliverables as the founder?
I guess firstly, still very hands-on in here every day. I previously wasn't because I was flying around delivering training, but since COVID, I'm in here every day. So my day-to-day pretty much looks like I'm sitting in front of a camera on Zoom, coaching people around the art of the Swish sales methodology, so all around the world. I got really set disciplines with my daily structure now, just because I've got two young babies. I've got a 2-year-old boy and a 6-month-old boy. So my aim is to be always home by 5:30 till 8 is family time. So I will do 15 hours of Zoom training or physical training a week for different companies. The rest of the time I'm either training my own team internally, so here on the sales floor, working with a marketing team, creating different marketing strategies and campaigns, hosting web classes. We run 2-day sales boot camps once a quarter, which I deliver. They're like 2.5 days, 25 hours, really, really intense. And then business development. So things like this, like podcasts, either being a guest on or hosting my own podcast, working on the user experience within the Swish Academy. So we've got an online education program called the Swish Academy. So creating new content for that, engaging with members of that, hosting live sessions in that weekly as well. So pretty full calendar, but absolutely love it, and still selling as well. Like I love selling. So obviously I'm not on the floor every single day doing regular outreach, but I'm talking to the government about partnerships, the big four banks, and a few other big things on the go as well.
And then that was probably my next question, was because you work with so many partners and clients. What have been some of the observations and learnings there? Because I know just if you do Google search, you work with some big brands, but also some small businesses and family enterprises, right? Have there been any learnings there around what success looks like for them from your eyes, not just in a today session sense, but in general, whether it's people or processes or strategies? What have you found that separated your best clients from the others?
Yeah, awesome question. I think one of the first lessons with regards to clients is that we are totally industry agnostic. I think I thought naively, because my sales life was born out of a call center, I thought that maybe our focus would be people that are just selling over the phone. But it's really evolved into a lot more than that. Whether it be, like say, you've probably seen some of the names on the website, whether it's in automotive, whether it's in beauty, advertising, lawyers, finance, it doesn't matter. So it's more around the art of communication, and there's not one business out there that can't benefit from articulating the value of what they do better. Some of the big takeaways as well are that, and this is probably a bit of a kick to the ego, is that digital training actually gets better results than physical training over time. So physical training, if we go in and do like a workshop or a conference just for like 3 hours or an 8-hour day, whatever it is, you see a big spike initially in results, and everyone gets that sort of 48-hour motivation, and those and they might use and implement some of the skills for 4 to 6 weeks, and then we default back to our old ways. With digital sales training or any online training, we've been doing it for 5 years now, it gives us an ability to hold people accountable and make sure that repetition becomes unconsciously competent. So 15 minutes every couple of days is way better than a one-off conference. And then the other takeaway was that we don't have to do sales training to increase your sales. And that might sound strange. I'll just explain that a bit further. Is that what we've tried to create is, I don't really like the phrase, but people understand it when I use it, is a bit more of a holistic approach to being a sales training organization. So it's more than just building rapport, overcoming objections, and how to follow up. We also go through like mindset and headspace and goal setting, and how to find purpose, understanding the learning journey that you go on, all the way through to how to harness a world-class culture as a team. So leadership skills, morning meeting ideas, emotional intelligence, behavioral science, like those types of things. And what we found is quite often, even if they go into our online program, it's one of the first modules in there. But if I'm doing physical training, this will often be asked for. I could do a goal setting session with a team, of which, again, I said earlier, I didn't used to believe in. We could do goal setting and mindset and purpose, and we can see an instant upside in sales before we get into any actual sales training. The same as daily structures. So we offer up daily structure training based around some of the training I've had from Glenn Richards, one of the sharks. And that itself just brings about more efficiencies in people's day, which even if you're, you don't improve your sales acumen, if you're more efficient at it and you can have more conversations, then you're going to increase your sales. So there's some of the lessons I think I've taken over the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating space. And I think one of the things you spoke earlier about impact, I think the other word is trust there, right? Not just trust between you and your client, but the client getting success with their customer or the end user is also a sense of trust. And I think that's probably the learning I've had just through the podcast as well, because we've had a number of guests who've either gone from a corporate career into a personal coach or a corporate coach in an individual sense. They've talked a lot about the trust element that doesn't just happen through competency, but it happens through that connection with people.
100%. Like I go through my four levels of going from salesperson to trusted advisor. And I think regardless of what role we're in, the second you start promoting a product or a service, or you're opening up a discussion to do that, you're seen as a salesperson. And whether we like it or not, there is a stigma around that. And people will have a preconceived misconception or validated idea around what you might be like. So the easiest way to get away from being seen as a salesperson is to ask questions, and then you're seen as a consultant. But then you want to go from consultant to advisor, and then the best way to get from a consultant to advisor is to ask deeper questions. So we always talk about getting under the iceberg and primary, secondary, tertiary level questioning, so you can get a deeper connection. And then the final stage is that trusted advisor status. And the way we get there is through vulnerability. So how much are you genuinely opening up about yourself so that they feel that connection? They don't just hear it, but they feel it. And at that stage, you start getting people ask you, Ryan, what do you think? What do you think we should do at this stage? Well, as you said, you've been through this. You get it. You know where we're coming from. You've got the experience. So it's intentional language done with integrity, because people get confused with sales training. They go, well, I don't want to manipulate and bully people. And it's not about that. It's about telling your truth better. Mm. Everybody has a truth. Everybody has a product or service. Well, not everybody, but most people have a product or service that they believe in. And how can we help you articulate that whilst telling your truth, whilst being vulnerable, that endears you enough that at the end of it, they ask you for your advice?
Yeah, I must have just round that out, that sales, and I remember reading this article a couple of years ago, is done in a daily sense as well. Like even just asking your wife that we should go to this restaurant, or telling your kid that he should wear this t-shirt or this car, is selling in a very basic sense. So I think we're all salespeople at the end of the day in any form, whether you're a lawyer or a banker or working at a local KFC. I think we're all sales. To your point, it's sometimes fabricated in a view to make it sound negative, but it's actually just trying to get people to buy into your thought, perhaps, right?
Yeah, 100%. Like that's one of my keynotes that I do is sales, a noble trait. Like I believe it's one of the most noble traits you will ever acquire. And there is a beautiful irony in what you just said there. If you've got somebody that's trying to convince you that they're not in sales, by default, they're in sales. And it's weird. So it's like, I'm not in sales. It's like, really? Prove it. And then they start trying to tell you why they're not. And that is a sale. So it's an interesting.
Well, I think kids are probably the best salespeople, right? Because they want candies or they want this toy or they want that. And they've got a way to get it from you. So they sell you the dream.
they just scream. Well, mind them. They just scream and you want to get away from that embarrassment, that pain as quickly as possible. So you give them what they want and they stop. It's genius.
Now it's time for the final sprint, Ryan. Just some rapid fire questions to finish us off.
Yeah.
Is there one investment you've made that you consider the best in your life? And it doesn't have to be financial.
Oh, one investment. I'd say my time. What I mean by that is after a conversation with Glenn Richards, I blocked out from 5:30 till 8 o'clock every single night for family time. So that I know it's not a financial investment, so hopefully that question went where you wanted it to go. That yeah, investing in me and sticking with it and conditioning everybody around me, my work colleagues, my clients, and saying from 5:30 till 8 o'clock, guys, you don't get me. And that's okay. And that meant that I got whatever balances, I got some level of balance back into my life.
One thing you'd like to learn in the next 6 months?
One thing I want to learn in the next 6 months is it was a business goal, right? It was to secure a government contract and get have an ability to provide training for every single business in this country post COVID. So I guess the learning would be how can we create a product? I mean, it is kind of there, but how do we provide a product that is will benefit every single business, 2.2 million businesses in Australia?
Is there one mantra or kind of quote that you've kept through your life that's been your inspiration in down times?
Always go to bed more educated than when you woke up.
Love it. And last one, mate, is there one thing you do every week to get the best out of yourself mentally and physically?
Not formally, but gratitude in general. So I've got this little, it's like a pre-match ritual, and it helped me from a public speaking perspective. I met a guy called Michael Crossland that you might have heard of. He, do you know Michael?
I know of him. Yes.
Yeah, he's amazing. You should get him on here. I asked him about public speaking, and I said, "Oh, do you get nervous?" And he's like, "Are you kidding? I'm so nervous." And he gave me this little 3-step process that he does. Which was meditation, appreciation, and practical application. And I just turned it into an acronym, MAP. Don't forget your map. So wherever I go now, I don't forget my map. So I have little moments of, I don't meditate per se, but I have 60 seconds of silence. In that silence, I'm showing appreciation or gratitude for what I've got. And then practical application is just maybe like a few star jumps, 30 seconds of star jumps, or just something to get the blood flowing. And I found that gives me an ability to reset at any moment.
Fantastic, Ryan. Well, that's the finish line. Thank you so much for making the time. I know you've got a million things on, so appreciate your time. And thanks for sharing your story. I think you'll inspire a lot of listeners who want to follow in a similar path.
Really appreciate it, mate. Thanks for having me on. And I do hope everybody finds that valuable.
I hope you took away some actionable insights and learnings from this conversation to apply to your lives and be 1% better every day. And I look forward to sharing the next episode with you next Tuesday. Stay tuned.